Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All of our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School, so listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Nick Beaton is a celebrated and dynamic leader. He's also one of Britain's foremost e-commerce retail execs. When he took up the role of Chief Finance Officer at ASOS in 2009, the company was a fledgling online fashion retailer with 200 staff and £160 million of revenues. When he stepped down as chief exec 12, 13 years later, the company's workforce was 3,500 and its annual revenues were £3.9 billion. He transformed ASOS into a global e-commerce powerhouse. But Nick started his career as a chartered accountant with KPMG. His leadership journey has also included stints as head of finance at high street retailer Matalan and then at Britain's biggest operator of late night venues, Luminor. Until earlier this year, Nick was CEO of luxury fashion retailer Matches Fashion. He's also chairman of the Secret Sales Fashion Retailer. He says that one of the most important leadership skills is the ability to embrace change, advice on which he has built a stellar career in the fast-moving world of fashion retail. Nick Beaton, it is our great pleasure to welcome you to this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you, Mike. That was a hell of a roll call as well.
Thank you for that. I was doffing my cap as I actually read it out. So you're probably best known for those 12, 13 years at ASOS, six as CEO. As I said, when you walk through the door, less than 200 staff, revenues of 163 million. When you step down in 2021, 3,500 staff, turnover of just shy of 4 billion. So what was the leadership difference that you made there?
So the every stage of the journey, we learnt a different way to lead the organisation and a different way to manage the organisation. So the biggest aspects of it was adaptability and changing to the circumstances. There's different thresholds in a business where you need to do different things and learn different mechanisms and learn different styles. So for example, when it was small, you could touch the size of the organisation really easily. When it was big, you couldn't. So we used to focus on the task of how do we make ourselves feel smaller as we get bigger? And that requires different mechanisms, different ways of leading. So that was one of my learnings through all of that. But the biggest thing I'd say was I put in purpose, mission, and values. I wanted the organization to be driven by purpose, guided by its values, and relentless on the mission. And anyone who worked with me during those 10 to 13 years at ASOS will know the mission, will know the purpose, will know the values, and they'll know why they're there, they know what we're trying to achieve. It doesn't matter whether you're in finance, logistics, technology, or product, they all know what we're trying to achieve and why. So I think that's probably the biggest difference I gave. My style through all of that was one of being humble in service of that mission, focused on the customer, and the being relentless in all of that, and being the coolest person under pressure. When something goes wrong, you've got to be the coolest person. And I did lots of mental triggers with the organization. Every time there was something went wrong, I go, guys, it's just another bump on the road. And every bump on the road we take as a galvanizing moment. It ain't a failure. It's something we've just learned. And we build new muscles every time there's a bump on the road. So I hope those are some of the things I left the organisation.
I've heard you wax lyrical about all this idea of leadership being a set of skills that you hone over a period of time, and there's no such thing as a born leader. But growing up, did you not know that you'd always be in charge, whatever you did?
No, I didn't. It's a really good question. No, I didn't always know I was going to be in charge. In actual fact, one of the happiest times I had was when I wasn't in charge, when I was the number two, because it gave me the ability to influence where I need to influence, didn't have to soak up the punches that the leaders had to soak up,
yes.
And be alongside the throne without having to do the grand gestures. I didn't always know that. But what I was doing is I was on this, I am going to keep getting better. I'm going to keep honing my skills. And where it takes me is where it takes me. I didn't go, I am going to be that. I'm going to be the following. I just went, I know I'm going to get better. And I know I've got to be disciplined about honing my skills and adapt myself. You can't be the same person for 30 years and expect to get a bigger role. You've got to grab what's in front of you, build new muscles, experiment with it. Don't be afraid of screwing a few things up and just go, let's go again.
So you weren't captain of the football team or captain of the cricket team or, you know, the star player on the rugby team or, you know, somebody, I don't know, might have been elected head boy or something of that nature.
No, I was enthusiastic participant in all of those things, but distinctly average in most.
Right, OK, there's a candid admission for you. OK, I'll give you that.
I was once a captain of the house sports team when I was at Sixth Form College in Nottingham. But I'd got a number of essays that I needed to hand in, so I didn't make it because I went, I've got to get these essays done. So I had to apologise in advance for the only time I was captain of the house sports team.
So you kept your powder dry in your leadership there, didn't you?
Indeed. Thought I'd better get my essays done, otherwise the lecturer was probably going to remove part of my vital organs.
You've started talking about Nottingham. Of course, you went to college here, and then you started your career as an accountant here, which is a bit different from fashion, I guess. But I believe I heard you say that those 10 years that you spent as an accountant with KPMG gave you the confidence to do other things. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. So after my A-levels, I joined an accounting office in Nottingham. At first I joined up to be a Royal Marine officer training. My mum wasn't blown away by the prospect of me becoming a Royal Marine. When the opportunity to work in the accounting office over the summer was presented, she kind of like pushed me into it. I said, look, I'll give it a go. And that was the days when small businesses and traders would turn up with a bag of invoices and a few bank statements and say, can you tell me how much money I've made and what assets I've got? And so it's literally pencil and rubber. And I quite enjoyed it. I found myself good at it. I looked around at all the people I was working with who were, and I was doing the same job as those, but they had good degrees from good universities, better A-levels than me. And I hadn't done that. And I went, well, maybe I could do this. And maybe the only difference is they've actually knuckled down, got their act together and applied themselves when I hadn't. So I went, I'm going to do that. So I then went and did two new A-levels at night, did accounting and economics. I then got taken on by KPMG, and passing my chartered accounting exams was something that's given me the confidence to know I've got the mental discipline, I've got the aptitude, I've got the ability to dig in when necessary. And that's always given me confidence to go, there's very few things that will come to me that actually I can't therefore figure out. If I go back to my mental discipline that was taught through the education process, through the experience of chartered accountancy, and if I get out of the way of my brain, I can figure it out. And so I go back to those disciplines and processes regularly that was taught during that education cycle, because it gave me the confidence that I've got the mental robustness, the endeavour, the focus and discipline to dig in when necessary.
A lot of very successful leaders seem to have started out as accountants. Did you realise that? Was that a conscious decision to go accountancy, or might have been anything else? Just that's what popped up first.
No, well, I was going to join Royal Marines, so choosing accountancy after Royal Marines couldn't be polar opposite. I never knew I wanted to be an accountant. And when I was doing it, I loved what it was giving me. I loved the exposure. I loved the focus. I loved the education. I loved the experience. But I never thought I am now going to finish my days as a chartered accountant. What I thought was, I am now going to use what I have learnt to actually go and do something way more interesting. I was fascinated by business. I was fascinated by how figuring what customers do, figuring out how to get the best out of people. And I'm going to take this skill in my locker and try and take it elsewhere and build new muscles as I go.
Yeah, that's been a theme, hasn't it? You've said that you've said you like experimenting, that idea of embracing change. So how does a leader know which changes to embrace and which ones to ignore?
Right, so you can start off and go, if you experiment, you find the right answer. Very few things are preordained. If you work in consumer and fashion and retail, you don't know what, with technology, you don't know what's going to excite the customer. So you have to try something. It's a bit like when they invented text messages for mobile phones. They were designed for network messages. They've never thought for a minute that people will interact through text message. But then they found it worked, so they followed it. So experimenting on something and then going, right, let's follow it. And if it works, keep on going. If it doesn't, go again. Right. So one of the values we embodied at ASOS was never be afraid to turn left when others turn right. Because if you turn left, you'll find something interesting. And if it doesn't work, you go again. So it was kind of like the experimentation is one of the aspects of entrepreneurship. And it's one of the aspects of building great businesses and building great muscles. So it wasn't a natural skill when you come out of chartered accountancy. So it was a muscle I learned and pushed. Now I have guide rails about it. And I found as businesses got bigger, they got less experimentation and therefore less entrepreneurial. So I was like, how do I keep putting entrepreneurialism into the organization at whatever scale? And I borrowed other mechanisms and other mental triggers. So there's one from Jeff Bezos of Amazon who goes, if it's a one-way door, sweat the detail and really think about it. If it's a two-way door, get it done and see what happens and sweat the outcome. And when you break down business decisions like that, you will find many of them are actually two-way doors. So you can try it. If it doesn't work, no damage done. But organizations get scared of experimentation and getting that done. And the other bit is you've got to realize as a leader, the best ideas don't come from the boardroom. The best ideas come from your team and your customers, and sometimes by watching what your competitors do. So you've got to set your antennae to pick up the best ideas. And sitting in the boardroom going through PowerPoint presentations ain't where that's going to happen. So you then go, if that's where the best ideas are, and that's how I'm going to get the best way of building my business, then you set your leadership style to encourage and enable and focus on it. And then people follow you.
One of the things that drops out of that for me is you must have to recognize failure fast and get out before you end up going down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, you do. So if it's a two-way door, and let's say you brought me an idea, Mike, and I'll go, I'm not sure about that, Mike. And you go, look, Nick, if it doesn't work, we can get out of it without betting the farm. And it's therefore a two-way door. I'll go, okay, Mike, get it done. I would then sweat the data with you. And so I go, give me the outcomes you're looking for. Let's then sweat the data. Let's not sweat the business case because we just don't know. And sometimes you just don't know. So let's see what the change does, sweat the outcome. And if it doesn't work, Mike, we pivot. If it does work, we go again and you're right.
Okay, so if that two-way door is the ability to get out.
Yeah, and that's the mechanism where you sweat the data. And you have to be, and to your question, you have to be, I don't use the word failure.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that sets judgment. There's no judgment on experimentation. I should applaud you for giving something a go and having the bottle to go, I want to try this. And so I reward that behavior, and therefore it's not failure. It's right, that's not worked out, Mike. What did we learn from it? Well, we've learned this, and this. Okay, that's cool. We take that forward. How do we pivot what you've done?
Moving on, I've read a lot of the stuff that you've written, because you're very thoughtful about your leadership, if you know what I'm saying. So you've written a lot. You're very generous with putting it out there as well. So I read a lot of it online. So this is something you focused on, but it's a very wide question to ask an online retailer. What did lockdown teach you about leadership?
So I'll tell you a little bit of story about lockdown. And it was a time of national crisis, national pandemic, and you know, we lost lives earlier, and so all of that backdrop is acknowledged and was regrettable. However, in ASOS, I absolutely loved the things we were able to do during lockdown. It took away the shackles. It took away and it went right back to the entrepreneurial approach of getting stuff done. The pandemic originally was a Chinese problem, and we then thought it was a supply problem, and then it became a demand problem. And none of us expected it to be a demand problem. And then it became a social problem, and then it became many other problems on the back of that. So during the course of between January and March, I made a few phone calls to our Chinese suppliers, and there was absolute panic and terror in their articulation to me. And I was trying to get round the understanding. We'd analyze the supply problem. We went, right, we'll have this amount of product that won't work. This is what the impact will be. Let's bring some other product in and we'll cover the gap. Thought, got it. I suddenly then went, this could be very different. And I called the CFO one morning and I said, Matt, we've never really tested our disaster recovery plan. And he went, yes, we have, Nick. We signed off on the board every year, blah, blah, blah. I went, Matt, we haven't taken it for a spin to see whether it really works. And then he stopped and went, no, we haven't. We'd been through the routine, but we hadn't drilled it. So I went, we need to do that in the mount, mate. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, what happens if our staff aren't at work? What happens if we can't shoot products or models in the studio like we're used to doing? Have we got enough laptops? How are we going to run the studios? How are we going to ship goods from a warehouse got 5,000 people in with social, if we end up with social distancing? So we went through a detailed exercise for 6 weeks where we absolutely proved it. And I came up with a little catchphrase. I called it various levels, DEFCON 1 to DEFCON 5. And I did that to remind the organization where we were in the process when we did it. So DEFCON 5 was this, and we were going to do the following. DEFCON 3 was this, we'll do the following. DEFCON 1 was this, and it was a fundraise. So I then presented it to the leadership team. So they went, so they sat there and they went, we're now prepared if something bad happens. And then we hoped we'd never have to deploy it. But what it did is it taught us an awful lot about the organization. Then the lockdown occurred. We could see, because of e-commerce, we could see all the data. So we knew exactly what was happening in Northern Italy. We knew there was a 2-week period from lockdown where nobody bought any clothing at all. And then we saw in the following 2-week period, it started to be a trickle. And then after 8 weeks, they started to buy again. And we analyzed all the data in the Lombardy region. So then we saw it go to Spain, then we saw it go to Germany, then France, then the UK. So I'd got a pretty good view of how I thought the UK customer would behave based on that data evidence. So we moved quickly through the DEFCONs, and I went DEFCON 1 really quickly because I went, right, guys, the sales decline is much bigger than DEFCON 4, 5, and 3. We're going straight to 1. And the organization knew what that meant. So I went, you're all at home. We've built the laptops. You've all got laptops. This is how we're going to run the studios. This is how we're going to do the warehouse. 3 principles. Keep the staff safe. Keep the business safe. And then we went, what are we going to do to answer the question, how do we lean in as a business in a time of national crisis? So those three principles guided what we did, and we got a load of things done. And we addressed all of those from, and I was proud of the way the organization pivoted. But also I was like fortunate and thankful that I'd made a couple of phone calls, and I suddenly made me realize that we need to do something far better than just having a prepared plan that was signed off of the audit committee every year. We needed to practice under that pressure. When the deployment of that plan came that we never wanted to do, we were quick through it. And sometimes agility in an organization to respond quickly and pivot quickly makes the difference.
Did you have a good lockdown?
Yeah, we did. And all e-commerce had a super boost during lockdown. So in terms of sales, it was great. In terms of impact on staff, don't know. And we did lots of things to keep our people safe, mentally safe. So we did check-ins three times when they're in the homes, three times a week. I would dial in randomly to staff team meetings, as would the exec members. We'd have a DJ play on Teams on a Friday afternoon, so you could just dial in and listen to the DJ play while you were doing whatever you were doing. We had all hands briefings three times a week over Teams, so every member of the staff still felt connected, still felt informed, knew what they were part of, knew what we were doing and why we were doing it. So we worked really hard on all those things, Mike.
Do you think business leaders are more compassionate post-lockdown?
I don't know the answer to that. What I will tell you is the best leaders talk about focus on teams, focus on customer and building culture to win. They don't talk about the execution of strategies, which is a given. They talk about those three things first. And when you hear them talk about those three things first, it also shows their empathy, their EQ, their understanding of people and customers and how you actually make organizations tick and work. So I think the best leaders do that already. So I would hope more people would go there, but more and more that you see the best leaders succeed in their organization, talking about those things should influence other people.
You're a big advocate of business and leaders being guided by a set of values. I mean, when you were at ASOS, you told staff that you wanted to chase the value, not the margin. You also talked about fashion with integrity. So why are values so important for business leaders?
It guides what you do and why you do it. I'm an ashamedly admirer of a capitalist approach, but I also think it needs a conscious approach to deployment of that capital, which is why I go, purpose drives our profit. Profit doesn't drive our purpose. And if you follow your purpose and you execute the things you need to do well, which is a given, it's not a differentiator, it's a given. And you should work on execution too, you will get the business that you want and the profit and the rewards will follow. So purpose drives profit, not the other way around. And when you do that, people, the teams follow you, you galvanize action, you galvanize people to follow because they understand why they're here and where they fit into it. And if you talk confidently about it to customers, customers tend to buy why you do something as well as what you do something. And in fashion, people don't need more clothes, but they'll buy more fashion when they understand the why.
Right, go on, expand on that last line.
Right, so a black T-shirt is a black T-shirt, but if you build a purpose and an understanding behind the brand, you are part of something, you are choosing as a customer to spend your money with a brand that stands for something that you stand for, that does something that identifies with you, that actually you share your money, time and effort with the brand that sits with you, rather than just going, that's a black T-shirt.
Okay, so does that drive for values, for authenticity, for transparency, compassion, as I threw in there, does that drive go across whatever you're doing? Or is it one of those things that you have to sort of look at who you're leading, look at what you're leading, look at what you're trying to run as a business person, and say how much of that is going to fit?
Yeah, agreed. Now, look, let me just compare and contrast. I started out as a chartered accountant, obsessed with sales growth, margin and profitability, right? And then I learned that the best way to scale the brand was to take those skills as an input and then exercise different models. And the why was something that came to me, which was the purpose. Why are we making these clothes? We're not just making these clothes because people want more of them. We're making these clothes because we're expressing ourselves, and people wear our garments because they want to express themselves in a particular way. So that's where the brand became important. That's where they're buying why we do something. So the purpose of ASOS was to give people the confidence to be whoever they wanted to be, expressed by their daily goals of great product and great experiences. That was the purpose. And whether you were in technology, supply chain, finance, or product, that is why you came to work, to deliver on that purpose. The mission was to be the world's number one fashion destination for fashion-loving 20-somethings. And let's hope we never got to that mission, because it's restless. It's forever mission. It's like the Nirvana state that we won't get there, but it just keeps on pulling us through. And the journey there is what the excitement is. And the values that guided our behavior was be authentic, be brave, be creative, be disciplined about what you do. So purpose-driven, mission-led, guided by values. When you get those right, and they're transparent in the organization, and you set that high bar, you as the leader have to adopt it. Otherwise, the organization calls you out as full of shit. And if you follow it, and you believe it, and you stand in it, and you live up to it, they follow. And customers want to be part of a brand that has something that they also believe in.
One of the attributes that you just chucked in there was bravery. And so you've also said that, you know, it's a key quality that you look for in staff and leaders should always aspire to. So on reflection, one of your recent roles was to be a CEO at Matches Fashion, a company which went into administration in March. So do you reflect on that and think, how brave was that decision for you to take on that role?
Well, it was totally following my values, right? And so my logical brain knew the upside and the downside were equally weighted. And I got persuaded into it, and then I went, this is a British brand founded by two British entrepreneurs. It's largely e-commerce. And I want to fix this because this is worth saving, because it means something. It stands for something. There was a lot of things we needed to fix that had drifted and had moved away from the original founders. But British-led founders, e-commerce, I went, I can fix this. And so I went, let's go. And so I was gutted when I wasn't able to complete that mission. I was gutted for the people that followed me. I was gutted for the brands that believed in the mission and stayed with us. And I was gutted for all the customers that got let down. But unfortunately, you also need capital to execute a turnaround. It had been loss-making for 5 years. And I was promised a level of capital. And then the funders changed their mind. They're right. And it gave me very little choices but to sell it quick. It ended up in the hands of Frasers and Mike Ashley. And Mike Ashley did what Mike Ashley did, which didn't need to happen in my view. We were making great progress. We'd halved the losses in year one, and we had a number of initiatives that I was in there 14 months before we had to sell it. And in the next 2 years, we'd have turned it around. No question. We assembled a great team. We had a great plan. We had a great strategy. We're breathing new life into the organization, and we were starting to move.
I think I'd better just go back to the start of that. I didn't quite explain that Matches Fashion was a luxury brand, which you were originally brought into, which was having problems, and which you were brought into to save, and it didn't quite work out as you've gone through. I mean, do you reflect on that? Would you have done anything differently now?
Reflection takes a period of time, Mike. And so I can tell you quite honestly, when it did go to administration, I was like, why on earth did you do that, Nick? And why
you mean join in the first place?
Yeah. But now I've settled a bit with it. I went, well, I know exactly why I did it. It's exactly the reasons I've just told you. I knew that the upsides and downsides were evenly balanced. I fancied the odds to skew it in our favour. And I was doing something that I believed in. It became a mission I wanted to achieve. And it's exactly what my approach is. And so I don't regret any of it. And I regret I didn't get a better outcome, but I don't regret taking it on in the first place.
So, as you've just shown, I think you're a very open, candid communicator, lots of public speaking, lots of, as I say, very generous pieces online. You're invariably popular with your staff. Do successful leaders have to be great communicators?
Yes, they do. They do. Because if you're going to lead, you have to realise you're not a leader without followers. And if you lead with a control bias, you become the spider at the centre of the web. And you become the slowest cog in the wheel. When you realise that actually you can scale a business through influence as well as control, and influence is infinite where control is finite, then you to dispense influence needs communication. Now, communication doesn't have to be an extrovert approach to it. It's a muscle you can learn. You can be a quiet leader, but have to have clear communication. And the reason for that is, as the leader, you are ultimately accountable and ultimately responsible for enabling things to happen in the organization that probably are by people, somewhere in a till point, somewhere in a customer care center, somewhere in a warehouse, where you can't directly control, but you can directly influence. So that communication needs to be clear, precise, consistent, uplifting, motivating. So everybody can identify with why they're there, what they're doing, how they're doing it, where the mission is. So communication is really important. But communication is one of those muscles that few of us are born with, but you can build. And you don't have to, but you can be an introvert with a strong communication gene. You can be an extrovert with a terrible communication gene. But communicating your mission, purpose, strategy, plans become really important. And it's one of those things that you should build as a leader. And one, you've got to get on your feet every now and then. Two, you've got to show up in the organization. Three, you've got to communicate to investors to follow you. Four, you've got to communicate to brands to join you. And you've got to galvanize the people under your responsibility to go forth and charge. So you have to be a good communicator.
Yeah, communication is so much more than being an extrovert. Completely get that. Okay, so looking back on your leadership, dead simple, what's the achievement you're most proud of, and what do you look back on and think, Lord Almighty, I really could have done that better?
The biggest failures I've made about around people and not getting the right people and dealing with the all the time and dealing with the bad choices soon enough. And I'll put that behind to, and so that's normally what I'd say. In terms of one of the best moments are when you realize the impact you've had on people and you were unaware of it. So, story of about 3 weeks ago. I was at the train station with my family, getting a ticket to go to London to, can't remember where we were going. And some guy came up and we were fiddling around with the train tickets, my wife was. Some guy came up, helped my wife, turned around, said hello to me and said to my wife and kids, "I used to work for your dad. He was a great boss. Really happy to help."
Oh, hey, how does that make you feel?
That's better than anything else you get.
Yeah. Did you remember him?
I didn't.
Well, 3,500 staff, I guess. I guess that's often difficult, is it?
And then, so that's happened quite a few times. And, you know, those are the things when you realise you've done something worthwhile. And leadership's not always a popularity contest. You're not all the staff are never going to go, "I loved him." And I never aspired to that. Early in your career, you do. Later on, you realise you can't be ultimately popular for everything you do. And it's not about popularity, but it is about respect. And it is about giving a bit about humanity, where even if you brought me something, Mike, that I disagreed with, I'd tell you why. And you might be cross that I haven't done it, and you might go, bloody hell, Nick's missing something. But at least I've told you why I didn't, or why I disagreed. And so that should be the bar, where you go, OK, I respect his decision. I disagree with it. And that happens. And that happens every day. And that should be healthy, where you have a debate. You're not going to agree with everybody, and neither should you. And neither should you try and be popular with everyone, because it's impossible. But at least you set a bar up. They should respect why you've done it and the time you've taken to explain it.
Right. So I wonder whether you've just this second answered this final question, that idea of offering respect to everyone. But here we go. So, hugely successful business leader, great career so far, obviously. So what advice might you give the current and future leaders here at the Nottingham Business School?
So leadership's not a right. It's a privilege. So make sure you treat it as such. And when you get picked to be we're all leaders in some shape or form. And so if you have a leadership position, make sure you do something with it. Don't just sit on it. Do something with it. And influence your organization. Influence the place that you work. Influence the place that you inhabit. Because everybody, when you use your voice, use your influence, can make a change. And all those changes, so use it. Don't be the person who's waiting to be asked to dance. Dance and go, this is what I think. And when you'll get promoted for getting shit done and show up in meetings. People love people that get things done. You might be the smartest guy in the room, but if you don't follow that with endeavor, focus, and getting things done, you won't get promoted. You might think you should be, but you won't, because people navigate and motivate towards people who do the things I've just described. And the other bit is, you could without a followership, you ain't a leader. So you got to create followership. You can only do that by building trust with humans around you. And you build mechanisms to enable, and you'll learn your own mechanisms. But you can't be a leader without a follower. And when you get that chance to use influence, make sure you do.
God, that's all so true. Get your hands dirty. Completely get that. Nick Beaton, it has been our fantastic pleasure to have you here with us on the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast. Thanks very, very much for taking time to join us.
My pleasure, Mike. Love to speak to you.
If you enjoy the NBS Business Leaders Podcast with Nick Beaton, why not listen to previous episodes with the MD of international print tech giant Xerox in Britain and Ireland, Darren Cassidy, the City of London banker, Dr. Heather Melville OBE, or the MD of global financial services company Experian in Britain and Ireland, José Luis Rossi. This episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast was produced and edited by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.